Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Israeli military will enter Rafah.
This victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Plus, water shortages in southern Africa.
In the 4 years that I have been your president, this is the fourth time I have had to declare a state of disaster.
And later, an update from Kyiv as heavy shelling in Kharkiv continues, and a look at what the European Court of Human Rights had to say about climate change. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Monday that a date has been set for a controversial Israeli military operation in Rafah.
Today I received a detailed report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals. First and foremost, the release of our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. This victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
He said this as a new round of ceasefire talks was ongoing in Cairo. A Hamas official on Monday said no progress had been made at the Cairo meeting after the Egyptian hosts said that some headway had been achieved. Rafah in southern Gaza has become a temporary home to over 1 million Gazans seeking refuge from the war. The United States, the United Nations, and most world governments are opposed to an Israeli incursion into Rafah, believing the cost to civilians would be too high. And an update now on a story we brought you yesterday.
Germany has demonstrated before the ICJ today that we are committed within the framework of international law to working to find the right balance in this challenging situation. Unlike Nicaragua, we are striving to do justice to both parties to the conflict. We are guided by respect for international law, responsibility for the security of Israel, respect for the suffering of the Palestinian population in Gaza, efforts to free the Israeli hostages, as well as by the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination in the context of a two-state solution.
That's Tanya von Olser-Gleichen, an advisor to the German Foreign Ministry. She's commenting on a case that Nicaragua brought to the International Court of Justice, accusing Germany of being complicit in genocide by selling weapons to Israel. Here's Nicaraguan Ambassador Carlos José Arguello Gómez.
Naturally, we heard a lot of commitments by Germany expressing the concern of all their authorities and what is happening. But the concern of Nicaragua is not the words of Germany, but the actions of Germany. I mean, they might be expressing concern, but at the same time, they are continuing their military assistance.
Germany is one of Israel's biggest arms suppliers, sending $353.7 million in military equipment and weapons in 2023. This according to data from the Economy Ministry. However, a lawyer for Germany told the court that since October 7th, 98% of arms exports to Israel were general equipment like vests, helmets, and binoculars. The humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza has also prompted calls for Washington to put conditions on the billions of dollars in military aid it provides to Israel as well. Reuters' Lucy Ha explains.
Israel has received more U.S. military aid than any other country since World War II. But the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is putting that assistance under heavy scrutiny and prompting calls for Washington to put conditions on the military funding it provides to Israel. Here's what we know about the level of U.S. support for Israel as it fights Hamas militants in Gaza. In 2016, the U.S. signed a record $38 billion agreement to provide Israel with military aid over a period of 10 years. $33 billion was for military equipment and $5 billion for missile defense systems. Israel became the first international operator of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, with plans for a fleet of 75 of the technologically advanced fighter jets. The U.S. helps fund Israel's Iron Dome short-range rocket defense system and the David Sling system to shoot down rockets fired from up to 124 miles away. A further $14 billion for Israel, proposed by President Joe Biden last year, is currently held up in Congress.
We're going to make sure Iron Dome continues to guard the skies over Israel. We're going to make sure other hostile actors in the region know that Israel is stronger than ever and prevent this conflict from spreading.
The United States has long used its veto power on the UN Security Council to block resolutions seen as critical of Israel. Earlier during the war, it vetoed calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Then, in March, for the first time, Washington abstained from a vote on a similar resolution.
Abstention.
Security Council resolutions need at least 9 votes in favor and no veto by the U.S., France, Britain, Russia, or China. Washington has also taken Israel's side elsewhere. Former President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the UN Human Rights Council to protest the body's criticism of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. In 2017, Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The status of Jerusalem, which is home to sites holy to Muslims, Jews, and Christians, has been one of the biggest obstacles to reaching a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians.
That's Lucy Ha of Reuters with that story for us. And as Israel wages war on Hamas in the Gaza Strip, it has also been staging more drone attacks and warplane airstrikes targeting high-ranking members of the Iranian-backed terrorist group Hezbollah. VOA's Lori London spoke with Lindsay Gradstein in Jerusalem about these rising tensions in the north.
Hostilities between Lebanon's Hezbollah and Israel are also sort of happening in parallel to the Gaza war. What's the latest that you're hearing?
It's been going on since the beginning, actually. But because the death toll has been so much less than what's been going on in Gaza, it hasn't gotten as much coverage. But there have been constant skirmishes between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel says that it has killed at least 100 Hezbollah guerrillas since the war began. The number might be higher. Some Lebanese civilians have also been killed. And both Israelis and Lebanese who live near the border have been forced to leave their homes. Now tensions are very high because an alleged Israeli strike last week in Damascus killed a senior Iranian general, the highest general who is in Syria. And Iran has threatened revenge. So Israel fears that Iran could use Hezbollah as its proxy to try to carry out a larger attack. And since the beginning, there's always been a fear that this could turn into a wider conflict and a full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah.
Right. And Israel said Sunday that it had completed another step in preparing for a possible war along its northern front. Would that be basically underlining that risk that you just mentioned?
Yes. I mean, Israel carried out a drill of what it would take to, you know, how a conflict would look. At the same time, it seems pretty clear that neither Israel nor certainly the Lebanese government nor Hezbollah really want an all-out conflict. And they've been sort of very careful to try to avoid hitting civilians, to try to, you know, be careful about what targets were hit. Hezbollah has been sending drones, most of which Israel has shot down. But there has been a conflict, but it's been on a low border. An all-out conflict between Israel and Hezbollah would really mean the destruction of large parts of Lebanon, and Israel has warned of that. At the same time, Hezbollah has rockets that can reach everywhere in Israel, big rockets, not small ones like Hamas. So the assumption is that if there really is an all-out war, Israel and Hezbollah have fought a similar war like that in 2006, and it basically ended after 34 days in a draw with no real victory.
Lori London hosts Issues in the News here on VOA. She was speaking with correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Iran's foreign minister used a visit to Damascus on Monday to warn that Israel will be punished for what Tehran says was an Israeli airstrike that killed two senior Iranian military commanders in the Syrian capital last week. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility for the strike that leveled a building next to the Iranian embassy. Israeli Brigadier General in Reserves Jacob Nagel is a former Israeli National Security Advisor and a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Nagel on Tuesday at the FDD office here in Washington and asked for his reaction to the Iranian foreign minister's warning.
The Iranians' actions inside Syria and this visit of this foreign minister, it's part of the real new axis of evil in the world, that it's Russia, China, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, all those very nice so-called people in the neighborhood. They are looking only to terror, to destruction, and to make sure that the world is not in peace. Now, the Iranians are responsible for almost everything bad that's happening in the world. And of course, they are still running for the nuclear bomb. People are even saying that what happened in October 7 was the first phase of a fourth phase plan of Khamenei. Hamas attacking, Israel goes in, then Israel is stuck, Hezbollah is coming, the world is joining, there is a chaos, and then Iran can run to the nuclear program alone. Now, we must make sure that Iran will not have nuclear bomb. Everyone is saying so. US is saying so, Europe is saying so, but it looks like the only one is acting in order to make sure that Iran will not have a nuclear bomb is Israel.
Are you saying that Israel is more concerned now about a potential Iranian breakout to a nuclear weapon than with Iran's repeated threats in recent days to retaliate for this strike on the building in Damascus?
There are two different levels of threat. Retaliation, attacking, this is all tactical. This is not existential threat. Iran with a bomb, it's existential threat to Israel, but also to the world. Just imagine how the situation was in the Middle East if Iran had the bomb at October 8th. Israel could not do things that they're doing. See what's going on in North Korea and things that the United States want to do and they cannot do. If a country that supports terror have a nuclear bomb, the world is not going to look the same again. This is why preventing Iran from having a nuclear bomb, it's a problem not only of Israel, it's also a problem of the world.
What can you say about Israel's strategy right now to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran?
Very, very important question, because in order to have a bomb, you need three parts. You need the fissile material, you need the means of delivery, and you need the weaponization, making the fissile material a bomb. Now, the means of delivery Iran have long time ago. They just have now to connect the warhead to the missile or to the UAV. The JCPOA and everything that we did the last 20 years is fighting against the fissile material, mostly the enriched uranium. The Iranians are continuing. If you ask me, I wish the Iranians would breach or run for the 90%, because the difference between what they have today, the 60% and the 90%, is only 2% of the time. And the Iranians are playing very smart now. They are getting paid from the Americans and from the world, not to do what they don't want to do, to go from 60% to 90. So what they are doing, they are working on the other areas. So in order to prevent them, we have to work now to prevent them from developing the weapon system, the scientists, the things that they stopped in 2003 when there was a real military threat on their head. We found out that the Iranians are stopping doing things only when they feel that there is a threat to the regime, threat to their life, threat to the country.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin. He was speaking with Jacob Nagel, a former Israeli National Security Advisor and a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's drought in southern Africa and water shortages in Colombia. Those stories coming up. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Ukraine has taken responsibility for the latest drone attack inside Russia. This as Russian forces intensify the bombardment of Kharkiv. The VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Two drones attacked the Borisoglebsk Educational Aviation Center in the Voronezh region in Russia before dawn on April 9th. According to Russian Telegram channels, the first drone crashed into the building around 3 a.m. An hour later, the second drone hit the same place. Reportedly, both drones exploded. No victims were reported. Ukrainian intelligence took responsibility for the attack. Andriy Yusev, a representative of Ukrainian intelligence, said in a comment to Radio Liberty that no details will be revealed, but according to preliminary information, the main facilities of the education center were affected. Earlier, Russian Telegram channels reported that despite attempts to shoot down the drones with small arms, two of them did hit the center. However, the Ministry of Defense of Russia denies this. Russian officials reported that four drones were allegedly shot down, two in the Belgorod region of the Russian Federation and two in the Voronezh region. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue the bombardment of the city of Kharkiv. For the past couple of weeks, Kharkiv has experienced constant intensive shelling. Russian forces use drones, missiles, artillery and bombs to target the residential areas and critical infrastructure of the city and the region. Victims are reported every day. President Zelensky held numerous meetings with the Ukrainian military officials to discuss new actions to be done for Kharkiv's protection. Also, Zelensky reported about negotiations with international partners to provide Kharkiv with additional air defense systems. Zelensky said,
"The focus of attention is now on Kharkiv, on the energy situation and support for people and businesses in the city and the region. We're maximizing our efforts to thwart Russia's plans against Kharkiv. Together with our partners, we're working to bolster air defense."
Kharkiv is believed to be one of the main targets for Russian future new offensive, experts say. The intensive shelling of the city and destruction of the critical infrastructure, creating serious issues with electricity and water supply, is seen as a potential preparation for the ground attack. Ukraine is actively constructing fortifications in the region. Anna Chernikova, VOA News,
And speaking of Ukraine, Britain's Foreign Secretary David Cameron is in the U.S. trying to drum up support for Kyiv and unlock Republican opposition to increasing American funding for Ukraine's defense. The AP's Charles Deledesma has more.
British Foreign Secretary David Cameron is in Washington to press senior Republicans to unlock money for Ukraine. His visit comes after he met a skeptical Donald Trump in Florida. Cameron says victory for Ukraine is vital for American and European security. But the former president is a critic of continued U.S. support, and lawmakers aligned with him are holding up an aid package for Kyiv in Congress. British officials haven't said how the meeting went. Cameron and Trump have had several notable differences of opinion over Brexit and other issues. I'm Charles Deledesma.
In climate news, the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that by failing to meet greenhouse gas reduction targets, the government of Switzerland has violated the human rights of its citizens. VOA's Laurie London is back with more.
In a landmark ruling that could have implications across the continent, Europe's top human rights court faulted Switzerland for not giving sufficient protection to the Senior Women for Climate Protection, a group which argued that older women are most vulnerable to the extreme heat that's becoming more frequent.
I am so, shocked, positively shocked, so happy, because we could do something. We could do something. We could contribute to the future, to a better future for our children.
A representative of the Swiss government who was present at the hearing acknowledged the decision and stated it takes seriously its obligation to execute the ruling. The court rejected two other similar cases, including one brought by Portuguese young people against 32 European governments. Climate activist Greta Thunberg was in the courtroom as the decision was announced.
It's a betrayal beyond words, and today's ruling is made
make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens. It cannot be a political choice whether to respect human rights or not. And this is only the beginning of climate litigation. All over the world, more and more people are taking their government to court, holding them responsible for their actions.
This was the first time an international court ruled on climate change, and the first ruling confirming that countries have an obligation to protect people from its effects. The decision could open the door to more legal challenges in the countries that are members of the Council of Europe, which includes the 27 EU nations, as well as many others from Britain to Turkey. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
In other climate news, residents in Colombia's capital, Bogota, will experience water rationing for the first time in decades as of Thursday due to low levels in the reservoirs that supply water to millions. The San Rafael Reservoir is less than 8.5% full, a historic low. Carlos Fernando Galán is Bogota's mayor.
Este esfuerzo busca garantizar...
This effort seeks to ensure that we can continue to provide the drinking water service this year, in the coming months, but also next year. That is why the goal will be to reduce consumption by changing behavior and reducing consumption via restrictions, both.
The rationing will affect more than 8 million people in Bogota and its surrounding municipalities. Water shortages, too, in southern Africa, where Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Zambia have all declared states of emergency. Lazarus Chakwera is president of Malawi.
This is devastating. It would have been devastating enough if this was the first disaster to befall us in recent times. But, unfortunately, in the 4 years that I have been your president, this is the fourth time I have had to declare a state of disaster.
Weather across the world produced record-breaking extremes in 2023 as climate change amplified the impacts of El Niño. A study in October of last year even suggested that climate change may now be as significant a factor in triggering El Niño conditions as natural causes, like sun's rays. Aid agency Oxfam warned last week that more than 24 million people in southern Africa face hunger, malnutrition, and water scarcity because of the drought. In response to the crisis, President Chakwera asked international aid agency donors to help the country avoid hunger.
All our development partners, the international community, all relevant United Nations agencies, the World Bank, non-government organizations, the local private sector, members of parliament, and all those who have any resources in cash or kind to spare, to avail those resources as donations to the presidential initiative to stop hunger.
An estimated 9 million people have been impacted by the drought in Malawi, this according to UNICEF. Meanwhile, the European Climate Agency says that Earth set record high temperatures in March for the 10th consecutive month. And that's going to end today's program. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.